From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the woman who leads the Cherokee Nation. We talk with Wilma Mankiller. Being the first female chief of her people is just one aspect of Mankiller's remarkable life that took her from her tribe's land in rural Oklahoma to a San Francisco ghetto and back again. Also today, we talk with Slovak novelist Martin Šimečka on life after Czechoslovakia split into two separate republics. Before the fall of communism, he was a dissident writer. His father was a prominent dissident who became an advisor to Havel. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg takes his daughter to Euro Disney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Election officials are reporting moderate to heavy turnouts for the governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey and the mayor's race in New York City. The polling indicates that the contest between New York Mayor David Dinkins and his Republican challenger, Rudolph Giuliani, could be one of the closest in 30 years. In New Jersey, Democrat Jim Florio is seeking a second term despite the massive unpopularity generated by a huge tax increase. His challenger is Republican Christine Todd Whitman. In Virginia, Republican George Allen is aiming to end 12 years of Democratic statehouse control in his campaign against Democrat Mary Sue Terry. Voters in California are casting ballots today in a special election. At issue are seven initiatives, two of which have proven especially controversial. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
The most contentious campaign has been fought over Proposition 174, a school choice initiative. The measure would give parents state-funded vouchers of about $2,600 for each school-aged child. The vouchers could then be used toward private school tuition, including tuition at religious schools. Public school employee unions have spent about $17 million to defeat the measure. The initiative's core supporters are libertarians and the Christian right. Another initiative has been receiving increased attention in the past week. It's Proposition 172. It would make a temporary half-cent sales tax permanent and designate the funds for local police and fire departments. Supporters say that without these funds, cash-strapped cities and counties will have to cut back police and fire protection. The wildfires that have ravaged Southern California in the past week may give a boost to this measure. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Frustrated by military authorities who refuse to step aside, the Clinton administration is threatening a tougher blockade of Haiti. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department.
The UN sanctions, supplemented by U.S. sanctions, are making life tough for ordinary Haitians, already the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere. The UN has blocked oil and arms. The U.S. has frozen the assets of the Haitian military and barred them from traveling to the U.S. Aware life can get even tougher, the Clinton administration is asking other countries to duplicate the U.S. sanctions, and it's warning it may go to the U.N. and try for a broader embargo. There is no certainty this will prompt the generals to step down, though, so the U.S. is also offering a carrot, a place for opposition forces, but not the generals, in a coalition with ousted President Aristide. So far, the generals who control Haiti aren't biting. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at a record 3,697.6. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading of 305 million shares. This is NPR. High winds are driving several new wildfires across parts of Southern California, destroying luxury homes and driving thousands of people from their neighborhoods. At least two people were critically injured in a fire that approached the exclusive movie star colony of Malibu, and fire officials say one person has been killed. The Environmental Protection Agency announced today the latest figures show urban air pollution is at its lowest level in 10 years. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The EPA data shows that the main components of smog, ozone, carbon monoxide, lead, and other major air pollutants hit the lowest level in 10 years in 1992. EPA officials credited the decline to the fact that tough provisions of the 1990 Clean Air Act were beginning to kick in. They pointed to last year's introduction of reformulated gasoline for a dramatic drop in ozone and carbon monoxide levels in many cities. The levels went down even though Americans are driving more miles than ever. EPA officials said that along with better gasoline, new, cleaner-burning cars are continuing to replace older, more polluting vehicles. The country still has a long way to go. The EPA data show that 53 million people still live in areas that violate air pollution standards. The good news is that number is the lowest level in 10 years. I'm Philip Davis in Washington.
Senator Bob Packwood continued today to press for a compromise that would allow him to keep much of his personal diaries out of the hands of the Senate Ethics Committee. The Oregon Republican is offering to turn his entire diaries over to a neutral third party. That official, former U.S. Appeals Judge Kenneth Starr, would give the committee access to material related to allegations of sexual misconduct, intimidation, and efforts to get lobbyists to hire Packwood's wife. Committee Chairman Richard Bryan told reporters he doesn't see any room for compromise with Packwood. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wilma Mankiller's life embodies many of the changes and continuing traditions of contemporary Native American culture. Although she spent much of her childhood in an urban ghetto, she has been the chief of the Cherokee Nation since 1985. She's the first woman to hold that position. Mankiller describes her job as part head of a small country, part CEO of a corporation, and part social worker. The Cherokee Nation claims 150,000 citizens and has an annual budget of $78 million. In her new book, Mankiller, she writes about her own life and about the history of her people. Let's start with Mankiller's name. Many people make the mistaken assumption that it's some kind of feminist joke.
The name Mankiller was actually originally almost like a military title. It was a given to someone who was kind of like a guardian of semi-autonomous villages that were scattered throughout the Southeast. And this one fellow liked the title Mankiller quite well, and he kept it for his name. And that's who we trace our ancestry back to. So it's my family name.
Has that name given you a lot of trouble because of misinterpretations over the years?
I think that it surprises people because of the name. I'm fairly soft-spoken, and people sort of have an image of what a woman named Mankiller would be like, and I don't think that I really fit their image of that goes along with the name. I've also learned to kind of tease people. If people give me a hard time about it, I tell them it's a nickname and I earned it. And I know it's an unusual name, so I'm not defensive or offended by people's reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think I should ask you to explain what the Cherokee Nation is and what its relationship to the United States government is.
Well, it's a government. The Cherokees have a long history of governance, and our relationship to the United States government is a government-to-government relationship. When the U.S. was forming, or when the colonies were forming, they dealt with Indian tribes and groups as separate nations, and that began this sort of government-to-government relationship that still continues today between tribes and the federal government. So I guess you could say, in a way, we're dual citizens, both of the United States and of our respective tribal governments as well.
Were there any objections to a woman taking on the role as chief? And I was wondering if there were any resistance from people who saw themselves as representing tradition when they resisted you.
No, you know, it's actually interesting. I think quite the opposite happened. It was a surprise to me. In the 1983 election, which was the first, during my first election, the only issue in the election was my being female. And that was a total issue in the entire election. And there was incredible opposition because of that. But the people who stayed with me in the 1983 election and who stayed with me through today, 10 years later, have been the older people in the tribe and the more traditional elements of the tribe. I thought that I've always found that fascinating, and my husband and I have talked about it, and I think we've come to the conclusion that maybe older people have a greater sense of history and understand that there was a time when women played a more significant role in the tribe and when there was more balance and harmony between men and women in the Cherokee Nation and Cherokee society.
You said the only issue in that election was your being a woman. What did the people who objected to you being a woman have to say?
Well, one of the things I remember they said was that our tribe, the Cherokee tribe, would be the laughing stock of all the tribes if we had a woman helping to lead the Cherokee Nation. Just those kinds of things, that there was, that there had never been a female chief in our history and that, you know, it wasn't meant to be and all that sort of thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilma Mankiller, and she's the chief of the Cherokee Nation and author of the new book, Mankiller, A Chief and Her People. Well, your family was uprooted when you were a child from Oklahoma to California. This was through the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation plan. How did they convince your parents to move?
Well, I don't think it was that hard to convince my father because there were too many children. We were farmers. We farmed both for our own food and also to market some of our farm products as well. And there were in the 50s, in the mid-50s, when the Bureau of Indian Affairs approached my father about relocation, there were too many children and simply not enough to go around. My oldest brother, Don, actually quit school to work with my father to help support us, and they would travel to Colorado to cut broom corn or do whatever they could to try to generate enough income besides the farm work to make sure that we had clothes for school and kept ourselves together as a family.
So your father was pretty sure that California would bring a better life?
Well, he had a vision that it would be a better life for his children. That's basically what the Bureau of Indian Affairs told my family and my father, that we would have a better life, that there would be a better life for his children and his family in California. And the better life ended up actually being a housing project in San Francisco.
Did the Bureau of Indian Affairs take care of you when you got to California or help you resettle?
They helped resettle, but I wouldn't exactly characterize it as taking care of us. We were put on a train in Stillwell, Oklahoma, and having left a very rural, isolated community with no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no paved road near our house, and then 2 days later ended up in downtown San Francisco in the Tenderloin District in downtown San Francisco with no kind of orientation at all. We didn't know what to expect. We couldn't conceptualize a city because we'd never seen one. And the farthest I'd ever been from my home was to Muskogee, Oklahoma. And so there was no preparation, at all for being in San Francisco. And then they were supposed to help us get a flat in San Francisco, and it wasn't there. And the better job that my father had been promised was a job in a rope factory and barely making enough to support us. And again, my older brother worked with my father to help support us. So they facilitated our getting there to California from Oklahoma, but I wouldn't say that they helped us.
So as an 11-year-old girl, you went from rural life in Oklahoma to the San Francisco Tenderloin District, which is the district of prostitution and a lot of alcoholism. Were you frightened when you saw all this? It was so alien to you.
I was very frightened. I remember especially my younger brother Richard and I trying to figure out what the sound of sirens was, because you have to imagine that we had never heard sounds like that, and we imagined that the siren was actually some kind of animal, and we were trying to figure out what kind of animal it was and that sort of thing. And to go to school with children my age and having never used a telephone or never rode a bike or used roller skates or any of those kinds of things. So it was a tremendous adjustment.
Were there many other Cherokee or Indians at all where you were?
Well, not too soon after we got to San Francisco, we discovered that there was the San Francisco Indian Center, which became a haven for us. That's where we could go and be with other Native people also who had been relocated, many of them from areas like ours. And so we found a little island in the large city of San Francisco where we could interact with other Cherokees and people from other tribes.
What was the motivation behind the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation plan?
Well, the motivation, as I see it, was basically to break up tribal communities and quote, mainstream, unquote, Native people. And the government has had a number of policies over the years basically designed to solve the, quote, Indian problem, unquote. And I think that the relocation program was a part of that overall process to try to get people to sort of leave behind who they are as a people and leave a sense of community and tribe and move to the city. Interestingly, the same fellow who was in charge of the Japanese internment, Dylan Meyer, was also in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation program for a time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilma Mankiller. She's the chief of the Cherokee Nation and author of the new book, Mankiller, A Chief and Her People. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Wilma Mankiller. She's the chief of the Cherokee Nation and the author of a new autobiography. Tell us how you got politicized. It was about the time of the Native takeover of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco.
For me, it was kind of like a watershed. All of a sudden, people were articulating things that I had felt but didn't know how to articulate, talking about treaty issues about providing adequate health care and educational benefits for Native people and that sort of thing. And so right after that, my whole family became involved in the Alcatraz Island occupation. Right after that, I volunteered to work for the Pitt River Tribe in California and worked for them for a number of years as a volunteer and just sort of got involved in the whole thing.
Now, I believe your father died during the occupation of Alcatraz.
That's correct. My father, who was sort of the glue that held our entire family together, died in 1971. And during the Alcatraz occupation, he died from complications as a result of being on dialysis from kidney failure.
He was buried in Oklahoma, where you had lived before moving to California. Did he express a wish to be buried there? Was it always understood that that would happen?
It was always understood that that would happen. In fact, interestingly, when we got on the train in Stillwell to leave for California, my father told my mother, I don't think I'll ever come back until I come back to be buried. And he always wanted to come back to visit and just was never able to do so. And so he was very prophetic.
Was the funeral the first time that you went back to Oklahoma?
No, I'd actually visited my sister, my older sister, just as a family visit and not an extended stay or anything before coming back for the funeral. But the funeral really, even though I'd been home before that, really was kind of a coming home, because when my father came home, even to be buried, a part of us came home. And then soon after, my mother started thinking about coming home. One of my sisters came home, and then I came home in 1977.
Are you living on the same land that you had lived on before you left Oklahoma?
Yes, I sure am. In fact, I can sit on my porch and look across the way and see flowers in the springtime that bloom that my grandfather probably saw as he walked around our land. And you'd go to the spring where I gathered water for drinking water for our house as a child, and where my grandfather and grandmother got their drinking water. So there's a great sense of history and family in the place where I live.
How did you get the land back, and what had become of it in the years that your whole family was on the West Coast?
Well, it's actually an interesting story because my father had been tempted to sell it several times through the years, and he desperately needed the money at many, many periods of time in his life, and he could just never bring himself to sell it, and even though he needed the money very badly. And so he kept it for his children, and I'm very, very grateful that he was able to do that. So I live there. My mother lives very near me, and then I have a sister who lives near me as well.
There was a car accident that you write in your book changed your life. This was, I believe, in 1979.
Right.
And you were actually hit by a very close friend of yours. Would you tell us what happened?
Well, I don't know what the odds are against something like this happening, but they have to be awfully great. I was in graduate school and was trying to live on a small scholarship and a graduate fellowship, and so I asked the people at the Cherokee Nation if I could do some contract work. And so I was driving from my home, took a day off from school, and was driving from my home to the Cherokee Nation in Tahlequah, and I guess she was in a hurry. She was always drove too fast, and there were three cars in a line, and she was in a hurry, and she passed these cars and didn't see me coming up a hill. And so I guess we saw each other for a split second because my car turned a little to the right, and so did hers to try to avoid one another. We hit one another head on, and she was killed, and I, you know, had many, many injuries, and it was very hard for me because not only was I injured very badly and all that, but I, you know, her death had a profound effect on me. I had for a long time, I guess, survivor's guilt. I didn't know that it was survivor's guilt, but, you know, I felt very, very badly about her death. In fact, they didn't tell me for about 3 weeks in the hospital that she had even that anyone had died, and nor did they tell me that it was Sherry. Her husband would come and see me in the hospital, and I'd say, "Well, where's Sherry?" And it was odd that he would come without her. And then finally, one day, I think they decided that eventually I was going to get out of traction and all that, and read newspapers or talk to people, and someone would tell me. So they told me about her death. It was a very difficult time for me, and so I, during that period of recovery after the accident, I had a profound change and matured a lot, leveled off a lot.
Well, you write that you, during this period of recovery, adopted what the elders call the Cherokee approach to life. What is that?
Well, I think the Cherokee approach to life is being able to continually move forward with kind of a good mind, and being able to not focus on the negative things in your life or the negative things that you see around you, but focus on the positive things and try to look at the larger picture and keep moving forward.
You came very close to death in the car accident, and you write that during that accident you lost any fear of death.
Yes, I did, and it's a special gift, I think. Having been so close to death, which, by the way, was the most wonderful feeling I've ever had in my life. It was more profound than childbirth, or better than, you know, being better than the deepest love I've ever had with a man. It was an incredible, unbelievable feeling of unconditional love, and very, very tempting to go on to death. And it was kept me, I think, from going on to death was thoughts of my children somehow or another came in that whole process. And then in a physical sense, there was a nurse straddling me in the ambulance who was beating on me and keeping my attention and keeping me from slipping away. But what was going on in my mind really was this sort of battle between whether I should just go on with this wonderful feeling or come back. And so it did have an impact on me. It made me not at all afraid of death, and also, I think, helped me understand my own insignificance in the totality of things as well.
You weren't feeling any pain after the accident? You were just feeling this warmth and good feeling?
No pain at all. No pain at all. I was so far away from physical, you know, my physical self, I think, at that time that I wasn't even aware that the woman was, you know, was on top of me trying to keep me alive until someone actually told me later. And so it was just sort of fighting this little battle of whether I should go on with this enormous feeling of universal love. And of course, I thought I was the only one who had ever experienced that until I later read books and talked with people who had also gone through the same experience or similar experiences.
Do you feel that you made a decision at some point to live?
Yes, I do think I made a decision. And I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but I remember that my two daughters came into the process somewhere or another in my mind or during that period of time, and that I probably made a conscious decision to live at that point.
Now, are there any Cherokee ideas or traditions that fit with the experience that you had?
No. The only thing that's happened that's kind of interesting to me, and I've not had time to really reflect on it, is that this Cherokee medicine man, who's a contemporary medicine man, had a dream about a kind of like a, I wouldn't call it a vision, I would call it a very intense, clear dream, that there would be a woman who would sort of rise from the ashes, so to speak, and who would help lead the Cherokee Nation. And when he met me, he was very startled because I looked like the woman. And so that's the only thing that, you know, that I can relate to that experience at all so far.
Well, it is pretty remarkable. You had this car accident in which your whole body was shattered, your whole face was shattered. And then after that, you lost a kidney to kidney disease. You had a form of MS that in which you temporarily lost some nerve control. It's just amazing to me that after this, you were able to become chief, to maintain your energy and focus your energy and be a leader.
Well, I think it's actually because of those things that I've been able to be a leader. And in a strange kind of way, sometimes very terrible events can have a positive side effect. And what those experiences taught me, I think, is that they taught me to be extremely strong, and they also taught me to look at the larger things in life rather than focusing on small things. And And it's also awfully, awfully hard to rattle me, truly rattle me, after having, faced my own mortality a couple of times. So the things that I learned during those experiences actually enabled me to lead. Without those experiences, I don't think I would have been able to lead. I think I would have been, got caught up in a lot of nonsensical kinds of things.
Your family is all back together now in Oklahoma?
All of my brothers and sisters except two are in Oklahoma. I have a brother, John, who lives in San Francisco, and my brother, Don, who gave me the kidney and who the book is dedicated to, lives in Escalon, California. But both are very involved in the family at home, and Don has a home in Oklahoma as well as California and travels back and forth between the two of them. So We've sort of come full circle from where we started out. We started out in this little, tiny, rural, isolated community in eastern Oklahoma, went to San Francisco, and then came full circle back to our homes again.
Wilma Mankiller, her new memoir is called Mankiller. She's the chief of the Cherokee Nation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Slovak novelist Martin Šimečka was a dissident writer when Czechoslovakia was under communist rule. Now that his country has split into two separate republics, he's something of a dissident again. Coming up, we talk with Šimečka. His novel Year of the Frog has just been published in the U.S. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us about taking his daughter to Euro Disney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Polls in Virginia closed just half an hour ago, but already indications are that it will not be a long night in the governor's race. NPR's David Mopus reports from Richmond.
No one is claiming victory or conceding defeat, but if a voter exit poll is on target, the Republican candidate, George Allen, will be the next governor of Virginia, and that would be the first such GOP victory here since 1977. The survey, taken today by the Mason-Dixon firm, projects that Allen will end up with 58% of the vote, 17 points ahead of the Democrat, Mary Sue Terry. However, Democrats are not giving up. They point out that 4 years ago, an exit poll indicated that Democrat Douglas Wilder would win easily, but as the night went on, Wilder managed only a squeaker victory, winning by less than one-half of 1%. More definitive official results are yet to come. I'm David Mappas in Richmond, Virginia.
In Southern California, there's been a new outbreak of fires along with high winds. Officials say at least one person has been killed, and two others are now in critical condition. Authorities say that a new wildfire broke out this afternoon in the hills northwest of Los Angeles. Fire officials have evacuated the Malibu Colony area, and one fire official said that they were merely trying to save homes. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senators Arlen Specter and John Danforth rose to defend their colleague, Bob Packwood, suggesting a compromise to allow an independent examiner to review Packwood's personal diaries. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
We're wandering a bit here, Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson said. Let's get back to equal justice, fairness to women, fairness to the senator from Oregon, and fairness to the other senators. Simpson was referring to hours of debate on a compromise proposal put forward by Specter and Danforth that would let former judge and Solicitor General Kenneth Starr review Packwood's diaries and pass on to the Ethics Committee only what he feels is relevant to its investigation. The committee, charged with looking into sexual harassment complaints made by 24 women against Packwood, isn't budging. Members are united in their effort to subpoena Packwood's personal diaries. Committee Chairman Richard Bryan says he will not set up one standard for Packwood and 99 other senators and another standard for 250 million ordinary citizens. It suggests, he said, that the Senate must have a greater level of protection. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Officials say that the government's index of leading economic indicators moved up 0.5% last month. The Commerce Department says in the first 9 months of the year, indicators have advanced 5 times and dropped 3 times. They were flat in July. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 5 points to close at 3,697.64, a record. This is NPR News. In Somalia, U.S. diplomat Robert Oakley met today with the leaders of the various warring factions in efforts to work out a peace agreement. With U.S. troops slated to pull out of the country by the end of March, there's been speculation that various groups are arming themselves in advance of a possible all-out civil war. A senior U.N. military official said that Oakley is talking with as many people as he can. A Los Angeles judge has refused to lower bail for the man convicted of felony mayhem in the attack on truck driver Reginald Denny during last year's rioting. Damian Williams is in jail awaiting sentencing. His bail is $580,000. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne has more.
The judge's decision to maintain the bail set when Williams was first arrested a year and a half ago means that Williams will not go free before he is sentenced next month. In moving for a bail reduction, defense attorneys argued that a bail of $35,000 was more appropriate to the single felony for which Williams has been convicted. In denying the move, Judge John Ouderkirk declared Williams dangerous. The judge said evidence at the trial showed, quote, the defendant engaged in a pattern of violence against five helpless people. Also today, co-defendant Henry Watson pleaded guilty to a felony count of assault and apologized in court for his part in the attack on another truck driver beaten at the corner of Florence and Normandy. During the Denny beating trial, the jury had deadlocked on that count. Watson could have received 7 years with a conviction. Under the plea bargain, he will be put on probation and be required to do community service. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
The government says that new home sales climbed nearly 21% last month compared to sales in August. Sales were up in every part of the country except the Northeast and were at their highest point in nearly 7 years. Many analysts had thought that home sales would be up in August, but only around 4%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When the communist government controlled every aspect of publishing in Czechoslovakia, Martin Šimečka wrote and published dissident literature. Now his novel, The Year of the Frog, first published underground, has been published in the U.S. Šimečka's father, Milan, was a prominent dissident who spent much of the 80s in prison. As the son of a dissident, Martin wasn't allowed to attend the university, he couldn't travel, and was only permitted to hold menial jobs. He and his father were both active in the Velvet Revolution. Democracy took a surprising turn when the country split into two separate republics. Šimečka lives in Bratislava, Slovakia. Šimečka was in the U.S. last week to receive the Pegasus Prize for Literature, and he told me that his father had been one of Václav Havel's advisors.
Well, my father was one of those writers who belonged to this group of intellectuals and writers in Czechoslovak underground. Václav Havel was one of those in this group. There were about around 20 to 30 authors. Names like Ivan Klima, you might know, and the others. And, well, they became very close friend with Václav Havel. And actually, I was also in part as the youngest author in that group. And for me, it was another kind of university to meet these people very often and discuss literature and politics. And, well, I was I was a witness of all these discussions with my father and Václav Havel about the politics and future. And it was a very strange situation because Václav Havel actually denied that he's a politician. And my father told him, was telling him all the time that, Václav, you are a politician. You have to admit it, that all things you are doing and writing is political, and if times will change, and my father was deeply convinced that the times had to change, that Václav would be one of the most important person in that country. So when it really started and happened in 1989, so the situation changed, and Václav Havel became a politician, but my father stayed independent intellectual. He didn't want to be involved in the political process. But then Václav Havel came to him and told him, look, you are responsible somehow also for these changes, and you have to help me. So my father, he agreed, but mostly because of Václav Havel was probably the only man who could persuade my father to join the politics. But probably it was not, maybe, I think, for my father, a good decision, because he then died three months after.
It's really tragic that your father died so soon after the end of communism in Czechoslovakia.
I think this was one of, you know, it's very difficult to judge it. I think that my father was one of those who was all the time this optimistic philosopher of optimism. He wrote and he talked about changes that had to come. Nobody believed him, but he was one of this really hope for many people. They liked to listen to him. They liked to write him, to read him. But probably it was for my father very difficult to be one of these very few optimists. And when the change came, I think was my father was one of these long distance runner when they finished or they were they reached the aim, they then somehow had no energy to continue in another life. I'm not sure about that, but I think this is one of the reasons.
What was it like for you after the end of communism? What were the things that you found most thrilling and maybe most disappointing?
Well, I was not so optimistic as my father was. When the changes came, I saw mostly not this very positive individual revolt against communism. I saw the masses, the crowds without real ideas, and I when then 2 months later, especially in Slovakia, actually appeared in after the changes already the first signs of nationalism. For me, was actually this for my skeptical soul, it was just that it was proved that the communism is much deeper in human soul than we believed. And now, when I'm living now in a country which where this nationalistic movement actually created a new state, and I call it well, just a continuity of one utopia to another one. It's where we lived in social utopias, which became actually in totalitarian system. So we now live, in fact, in a kind of ethnical utopia that, which is ideological in a very similar to social one. And for me, it is. I can't say I'm disappointed. I just know how it works, and so it's for me another challenge.
So you were sorry that Czechoslovakia split apart.
Yes, of course, but it was not only because I was sorry, because my father, for example, was Czech, so my origin, my roots are in Czech country, so, and I live in Slovakia. I'm a Slovak writer, but I have to, I'm asked to declare that I'm Slovak, that I'm not Czech, and this is a problem with identity. I don't want to declare very often, because then it loses its truth, and the problem in the split, that it was a space for, very natural space for hundreds of thousands of people who felt their identity like Czechoslovak identity. And now they have to deal with that situation that is quite unnatural, split without asking people if they really want it or not. This is a split without referendum. So it's not only that I'm sorry for the split, but more I'm afraid of the future, because I thought that this split was a result of ideological war.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Martin Šimečka. He's from Slovakia, and his novel, The Year of the Frog, has just been published in the United States. I'm going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Martin Šimečka. He was involved with the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. Now he lives in Slovakia. You said that the Slovak government wants people to stand up and declare their Slovak identity. What is being asked of you in terms of you making statements about your identity? You mentioned before your father was Czech. So what are you expected to do?
Well, I'm expected to do two things. At first, to declare that I'm Slovak, which I can't do it in America. For me, it's in America, it's no problem to say I'm Slovak and I'm a Slovak writer. But if I'm asked in Slovakia who you are, it means not that somebody wants to answer, but somebody wants to blackmail you, that you have to declare that you are Slovak. It means if you declare that, then you have to be loyal to that state. I mean, ethnic group and the state is the same. So if you criticize, for example, the state or the government, so you are not Slovak. You are, or you can't be, because if you are Slovak, you can't criticize government. This is the logic of those, Slovaks who wants me to make me to declare my Slovak identity. And this is a problem. I mean, I don't say that I'm Slovak in Slovakia, although everybody knows. And I am, you know, this is just a typical example that the Minister of Culture, who is, who doesn't like me very much, wrote about me in an article in a newspaper that I'm Slovakized intellectual. Means not Slovak in origin, but somehow not a real Slovak. This is kind of things which happen, that those who are critics are accused not to be Slovak enough or Slovaks at all, and this it creates just a tension in society, because many intellectuals are critical in Slovakia, but they don't want to be accused being not a Slovaks. And this is, and it is kind of ideological pressure you have to face, and this is more psychological and ideological than physical, but still this pressure is quite big.
If you had your choice, would you prefer to live in the Czech Republic?
I have the choice.
Have the choice?
Of course, many times I was asked to move. I was asked by Slovaks, I mean, who don't like me, to move for Prague. And not to bother Slovaks living there. I was also asked by Czech. They asked me very often, "Why do you live in Slovakia? You don't need to fight with them. Move to Prague, and you will have a good life." Well, I'm a Slovak writer. I just want to live there, and I don't want to somehow to withdraw and to give up. This is one reason. The other reason is that I really think that Slovakia is a very interesting country, and the situation there is, I think it's a very good chance for a process towards democracy. It's just and it's very inspiring for me, and I want to be part of that. So it's for me more interesting than in Bratislava than in Prague, I have to admit. To be a writer in Bratislava is now for me more valuable than in Prague.
Why?
Well, Prague started to be a very nice but more westernized city. It's almost, if you walk in the Prague and you just look to the first floor, you are almost like in Paris. All boutiques and shops are as in Paris or in London. Maybe if you look at the second floor, it's different, because second floor is still not repaired or reconstructed enough, and it remembers that reminds you that you are in Prague. But Prague is now really West European or Central European city, and sometimes mecca of many intellectuals and even Americans. There are 30,000 Americans in Prague now, and it's lost somehow its Kafka's identity. I liked so much when I was in Prague many times before. Bratislava is in this meaning very interesting city with a lot of tensions, but and sometimes very uncomfortable. But something is happening in Bratislava. I have a feeling that in Prague it's a little bit boring for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, what language do you write in?
Oh yeah, I write the fiction. I write in Slovak, but sometimes it is a very difficult situation for me, because when my father died, I started somehow, I didn't know why, probably it was something under the consciousness, I started to write in Czech too. And I discovered that this language, I have in fact two mother languages, literary languages. I can write as a writer in both languages. And I wrote some essays, and I continue in that, writing some essays in Czech. And, probably in Czechoslovakia I'm the only one who really have, as a writer, two mother languages. And I discovered that these languages are, on one hand, very similar, on the other, very different if you use them as language of literature. And I discovered of this big misunderstanding between Slovaks and Czechs they don't know how do they use actually their language. Czechs are very obsessed by their language. This language is wonderful, but this obsession is somehow it's a burden. You are obsessed by the language so much that sometimes it covers your thoughts, and you can continue in writing without discovering that you are writing just stupidities. But it sounds so well. In Slovak language is different. Slovak language is more modest, and you have to be very careful what you are writing about, because if you write stupid things, it immediately you will recognize it. And well, I wrote an essay about that, and it was a big scandal in Slovakia because Slovaks felt insulted that this language I wrote about that language as something more or less developed. What I don't think is true, but well, I just was accused again as anti-Slovak, although I am a Slovak writer and I write fiction in Slovak.
Writing in the Slovak language, that means that only people in Slovakia can read your book unless it's in translation?
No, Slovak language is so similar to Czech that every Czech can read in Slovak and every Slovak can read in Czech without any problems.
I see.
So the truth is that Slovaks read more Czech literature than in opposite, that Czechs are in this meaning more ignorant towards Slovak literature, and I have to admit that I wanted to cross this, and I was asked by a Czech publisher to be translated in Czech language. I just refused. I told them, look, you have to read in my book in Slovak if you want. If you don't want, so don't read, but I don't want to translate it in Czech.
Well, why not?
Well, I think that's for me very important that Czechs and Slovaks should know their languages, and they should continue in understanding of these languages. And if you translate these works, so you then lose your ability or desire to read in a different language. And I'm pretty sure about that every Czech can really read without any problems in Slovak. Even people don't recognize if they read in Czech or Slovak. They are so used to reading these languages. So I didn't want to develop this border between Czechs and Slovaks being translated into Czech.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hi, thank you.
Martin Šimečka, his novel The Year of the Frog, has just been published in the U.S. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Senator Bob Packwood is once again before the U.S. Senate, continuing the argument about whether his diaries should be turned over to the Senate Ethics Committee. We'll review the career of Dr. George Sheehan, the well-known running doctor. Dr. Sheehan died at age 74. He's written extensively about running at a later age and also about prostate cancer. Kathy Lohr has the story about the problems faced by parents who give up their children for adoption. And I'll talk with Custer LaRue, a singer from Virginia, with a new collection of songs gathered in Appalachia, songs from Scotland and England and Ireland.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of our regular commentators, linguist Jeff Nunberg, is working outside of Paris this year. From time to time, he'll be sending back pieces about how he sees his cross-cultural adventure.
I arrived in Paris, and I did what any tourist will. I took my daughter Sophie to Disneyland. Or, more accurately, to Euro Disney, the new park they've built in Marne-la-Vallée, about 25 miles east of the city. The Disney people were obviously reluctant to tamper with success. The park itself is largely a clone of the parks in Anaheim and Orlando. I had the feeling that an English tourist must when he runs into London Bridge in the middle of the Arizona desert. It seemed a proven formula, so it came as a surprise to just about everyone that the new park hasn't been a raging success. The Europeans, and particularly the French, have been staying away in droves. The European affiliate of Disney that built the park will lose around $300 million this year, and they've just announced 1,000 layoffs. There are a lot of reasons why the formula hasn't worked here. One is that the park is awfully expensive. For our little family of three, it was $160 just to walk in the gate, and this in a part of the world with double-digit unemployment. Then, too, the northern European climate can be a little brisk for this sort of outing. But as far as a lot of the French journalists and intellectuals are concerned, the park's difficulties have little to do with either economics or meteorology. They opposed the project from the outset on the grounds that it would be a beachhead for the further Americanization of French culture, and now they see a vindication in the fact that the French haven't much taken to it. They point with satisfaction to the relative success of a much more modest and conventional amusement park in the Paris region that's based on the popular French cartoon characters Asterix and Obelix, a sort of Mickey and Goofy pair of warriors from ancient Gaul. If you ask me, though, this is all a crock of Ratatouille. In fact, the French indifference to the Euro Disney Park has nothing to do with its being too American. Quite the contrary. When you visit it, you come to realize how much the original Anaheim Disneyland was based on a vision of Europe, the Magic Kingdom dominated by a medieval castle, populated by princes and princesses, and divided into tiny, crowded lands, each with its distinctive food and dress. Walt Disney's genius was to give us Europe without any of the ordinary inconveniences, tidy, safe, thoroughly English-speaking, with the bathrooms clearly marked. Even Mickey is Europeanized here. In the cartoons, he's a spunky little Republican character. But in the parks, he's transformed into something imperial, even papal, a silent figure escorted onto a platform as a line of roped-off children wait impatiently to be led up for a ceremonial laying on of gloves. What Disneyland is meant to show, in fact, is what we Americans could have made of Europe if only we'd had the opportunity. In its own way, it's a more pervasively coercive state than anything the Europeans have ever managed to put together. But it's an even-handed, friendly sort of coercion, monitored by smiling folks in boaters and cowboy hats. Just before the Euro Disney Park opened, the French press made a flap when somebody leaked a dress code that stipulated that all employees were expected to wear clean underwear. But of course, the Disney people were just trying to make sure that the legions who ran the park would be made up of nice, clean kids. You can't be too careful. Still, you can see how European visitors might not quite get the point of all this. They come to Marne-la-Vallée looking for an American amusement park. They're not on a transformative pilgrimage. So all that business about castles and kingdoms tends to go right by them. And they get a little testy waiting in line for the park's few rides, particularly since language differences tend to discourage the kind of camaraderie that develops among the people shuffling along in the lines in Anaheim or Orlando. What happens here is that the line seems to become an animal with all the worst features of its constituent parts. Everybody gets overbearing like the Germans, pushy like the Italians, dyspeptic like the French. They may or may not be ready for their own Europe, but it's for sure they're not ready for ours. Oh, and Sophie, she loved it to bits.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Dorothy Farabee, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reef are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company. M-I-C K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. Come along and sing our song and join our family. M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. Mickey Mouse, Mickey Mouse. Forever let us hold our banner high,
through the years. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rebuilding Sarajevo's infrastructure. We talk with Fred Cooney about his efforts to set up new water and gas systems in Sarajevo. Cooney is a disaster relief expert who's worked in Biafra, Kuwait, and Somalia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.